Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the last hour, we continue our discussion of Meet the Press, the roundtable of religious leaders that you may have seen on Sunday. If you didn't see it, we're trying to play as much of it as possible and get your reaction as well. Before we go on, have you been out shopping yet? I was a complete idiot. I went out on Friday. Now, I didn't go far, and I only went to one store, but that was enough. That was enough. Maybe you're looking for, I already got my pastor's Christmas present, by the way, when I was out. I won't tell you what it is. But if you're looking for a present for your pastor, I got a great idea. Why not foot the bill and send him to the 2005 Symposia Series at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana? Now, you can find out all about it by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. You'll find out about the Symposia Series, the very best of speakers from around the world, on two subjects. One, who is Jesus? And the third, use of the law. Both of these are very useful to your pastor in his everyday pursuits as the shepherd of the flock. He would love this opportunity to gather with other lay people and with pastors from around the world to hear the very best speakers and to participate in what I have to say. I've been to, what, three of these things or two of these things? To participate in some of the very best Gemütlichkeit you could possibly have. That's just a German word for having fun with other people that you could possibly have over the course of January the 18th through the 21st, there on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. There really is nothing else like it. January the 18th through the 21st on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We will be broadcasting live during the course of those 3 days, Issues, etc., there from the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary. Again, to find out more, just go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find a list of speakers, you'll find registration materials, and you'll also find out about costs and housing and things like that. issuesetc.org under the What's New section. Look for the 2005 Symposia Series at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Okay, back to the roundtable. We recently, before the break, heard Al Sharpton with one breath say that we shouldn't try to impose our values on others. And then in the very next answer, say, well, yeah, we're going to impose our values on others, and here's the list of values that I want to see imposed. Now, the subject of Martin Luther King Jr. has come up and the civil rights movement. Sharpton has made a contention that he's going to make again a little bit later, and that is, yeah, King was leading a moral movement, but he was opposed by the church. Now, when I first heard this, I thought to myself, what does he mean? Who in the church opposed Martin Luther King's civil rights movement? Now, what he's talking about, he's got Richard Land sitting across from him. He's talking about the Southern Baptist Convention. That's what he's talking about. Because the Southern Baptist Convention did oppose Martin Luther King Jr. officially for a long time. He's not talking about all Christians, but when he says the church, he means the Southern Baptist Convention. But he even concedes that Martin Luther King led a moral movement to change laws, to revise public policy, admission policies, city policies, to, if you will, impose morality.
To your website, Reverend Falwell, Faith and Values Coalition, Moral Majority Coalition, it says your purpose is threefold platform. One, the confirmation of pro-life strict constructionist U.S. Supreme Court justices and other federal judges. Two, the passage of a constitutional federal marriage amendment, which in effect would ban gay marriage, and the election of another socially, fiscally, and politically conservative president in 2008. Are you absolutely convinced, confident, that President Bush will appoint to the Supreme Court only someone who would overrule Roe versus Wade on abortion?
I don't think anybody knows that but George Bush. That certainly is my prayer and my hope that he will appoint men or women to the court who will overturn Roe v. Wade. That doesn't mean abortion stops. It means it goes back to the states where we have a multi-year battle, we pro-lifers, to bring an end to abortion on demand. And I, unlike my friend Al here, I think it's amazing that we're debating the right of a little child to be born, not just the right of a woman to take the life of her child at this late date. And I think it's unthinkable that we're debating what a family is, a man married to a woman They've got that right in the barnyard. We've had that for 6,000 years. And to think that we're trying to redefine families. So we obviously are juxtaposed on those two and a lot of other issues. But I think that it's more than just, he said, sex issues. I think it's a life issue. I think it's a family issue. I think it is a security issue. I think the president's doing the right thing in Iraq. He did the right thing in Afghanistan. I think he's doing the right thing in Homeland Security. I think he's doing the right thing in faith-based initiatives to minister to the poor through faith ministries, all those things. And I agree with Jim Wallace, not on everything, but I agree that it's much broader than abortion and family. But those are the front burner items. If you fail on life and family, I don't know where you go from there.
All right, this is Jerry Falwell on Meet the Press. I'd like your reaction to this, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be walking through this. We were not going to get through the entire roundtable, but we'll do our very best here. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. He was not willing to say that he had complete confidence in the president to appoint someone who would overturn Roe v. Wade. I'm not sure I have that confidence, to tell you the truth. It does remain to be seen. Now, the president has said that he's going to appoint people who are strict constructionists. Now, some people hear that as code for people who will overturn Roe v. Wade. And others say, well, and I'm thinking in particular in the president's own political party, say, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that the person who's appointed as a strict constructionist will be doing anything with Roe v. Wade anytime soon. A little something in that code for everybody, and I think Jerry Falwell is pretty astute, to realize that is all the farther the president has been willing to go on Wade, on Roe v. Wade, and the Supreme Court. Here's more.
This is an analysis by Alan Cooperman of President Bush's position on abortion. Bush had not actually said that abortion is tantamount to murder, nor, according to his aides, has he ever said that all abortion should be illegal. When asked by reporters during the 2000 presidential campaign and again last fall whether abortion should be banned, Bush said the nation was not ready for that step without indicating his position. If the president appoints someone to the court whose position on abortion is unclear, will there be disappointment in the evangelical Christian community?
I think what the president must do, and I think he will do, is appoint justices and appeals court judges who are strict constructionists. If they're strict constructionists, they will overturn Roe. Roe was a horrendous decision. It was a horrendous judicial overreach. It was an attempt to judicially dictate to the American people on basic values, and that should be in the political process. And it should be decided by the people. This is government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not government of the judges, by the judges, and for the judges.
All right, just a moment there. I think it's important to note here that Land is, he's got seemingly more confidence than Jerry Falwell does, and he's kind of deciphered the code for us. He says the president has promised to appoint strict constructionists to the Supreme Court. And if he does that, and that is, if they really are strict constructionists, Land contends, they will see right through Roe and they will overturn it. One would hope that's true. One would hope that that is true. And I have said many times here on the air that the best case to be made in the civil realm against Roe v. Wade is that it's just bad law. And 30 years of aging hasn't improved it one bit. It's bad law, and those things that have been built upon Roe are built upon a sinking foundation, legally. It was a bad decision. It wasn't just a bad decision morally. It was not a decision well taken by the Supreme Court. It was a low point, not only for them morally, but judicially. They didn't decide well. There was no basis for this. They even admitted there was no basis for it. They even admitted they were pulling a rabbit out of the hat. But I don't know. My confidence is not as strong as Richard Land's, because we might get someone who passes the litmus test of being a strict constructionist who will carry out the president's policy, which is, you know, we're not ready for that yet. That's the only thing the president has said definitively on Roe v. Wade. A couple weeks ago, we played you Scott McClellan's interchange with a reporter during a press conference where the question was asked, has the president ever expressed a desire to see Roe v. Wade overturned? And McClellan would not answer that question. Now, I don't know how much you want to read into what the president doesn't say, but in every other realm of life, when someone refuses to say something, when asked, can you say this? And they refuse to say it, it does tell you something. So at this point, I think Land's confidence is a little overstated here. Now, the subject stays on abortion.
And the president has a very strong 4-year record of sticking to his guns and only nominating for the appeals courts judges who are strict constructionists.
You would then,
Estrada, like Pryor, like Justice Brown in California.
And then states would have the option as to whether or not to outlaw abortion in their state.
Then, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, we go back to the situation status quo ante before 1973, when you had about 46 states that had very restrictive abortion laws, and you had three or four states that had pretty permissive abortion laws. I think that this is an issue about life. It's an issue about, I disagree with Reverend Sharpton rather strongly. I can't imagine in the 21st century, all we know about the life in the womb now, when the heart begins to beat before the mother even knows she's pregnant, it's not the mother's body, it's a human life, and I believe my grandchildren will look back and say, I can't believe in the early 21st century we were killing an unborn baby every 20 seconds.
If abortion is outlawed in a state, and abortions are performed by a doctor in that state, who's prosecuted? The doctor? The mother?
I see mothers as victims. I've worked in crisis pregnancy centers. I've counseled women who've had post-abortion traumatic stress syndrome. When an abortion takes place, there are at least two victims, the mother and the unborn child. I would prosecute the doctors. And we're ready to battle that out in every state and let the people's elected representatives make those decisions, not people in black robes.
Reverend Sharpton, this whole debate about abortion, many Democrats, centrist Democrats, who are personally opposed to abortion but don't want to outlaw it, but also say to the Democratic Party leadership, well, we do want parental notification. We want to know if our daughter is going to have an abortion. Or we want an end to partial birth or third-term abortions, if you will. Why can't the Democrats reach out on those kinds of issues, which would limit abortion but not outlaw it?
I think that they will. Let me say this firstly. I think that we have the debate over civil liberties that may not, in my opinion, be given the kind of airing that we should. I may agree. You know, Reverend Falwell and I talk. I have two daughters. My marriage just ended a couple years ago. We've changed. But I am very much involved in my daughters, and I talk to them about my daughters. If my daughters had an unwanted pregnancy, I would probably advise under any circumstances not to get an abortion. But I don't want the state to make that decision for them.
Okay, now notice two things about Sharpton's response here. First of all, he made a valiant attempt to change the subject. When asked about abortion and whether or not the Democrats would be willing to step up and at least agree on let's end partial birth abortion, let's end late abortions, and let's get some parental notification going on. I'd like to see parental consent. Whatever happened to consent? But just for the sake of argument, parental notification. Now, Sharpton started out by saying, oh, I think they will step up on those issues. Well, I'd like to see it happen. It hasn't happened yet. Now, maybe out of political necessity. The largely pro-choice party, the Democratic Party, will do that. I don't know. I'm not going to hold my breath. Now, he tried to change the subject to civil liberties. When that failed, he did, at least he said, look, I've got two daughters. If one of them had an unwanted pregnancy, now that's very interesting. He didn't say unplanned. He said unwanted. Doesn't change a thing. Whether a woman wants the baby or not doesn't change a thing. It's really irrelevant to whether or not this is a life worth protecting. We don't want all the poor people in our country that we have, do we? I mean, we want them as people, but we don't want the poverty that we have. But the fact that it's not wanted, does that alleviate us a responsibility to take care of the poor, the indigent? Of course not. Yet somehow when a baby is unwanted, that alleviates the mother and the father of any responsibility to protect that child from the abortionist. I just don't see the logic there. But he does say he would not recommend that his daughters have an abortion under any circumstances. That's good to hear. But what you have heard there, folks, and be careful that you don't misunderstand, what you've heard there is someone who has simply said in a more elaborate form, I am personally opposed to abortion, but I don't think it should be illegal. Now, someone's going to call him on this and liken this to the whole issue of slavery. How can you be personally opposed to abortion and not want to make it illegal? Wouldn't that be the same thing as someone saying, look, I'm personally opposed to slavery, but I can't see making it illegal? Well, we'll hear that in just a moment. I'd like your reaction to this audio from Meet the Press on Sunday, a panel of religious experts, Jerry Falwell, Jim Wallace, Dr. Richard Land, and the Reverend Al Sharpton, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, about 20 minutes left in Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, and you're listening to Issues Etc. Now, let's listen to how the conversation progresses from the issue of abortion and someone being personally opposed but not willing to impose that morality on anyone else.
Difference in values and imposed values. Secondly, in terms of the party reaching out, I think as we build a new party, there's a fight now for DNC chair, Wellington Webb. We're fighting with Congressman Greg Meeks and our activist Marjorie Harris and others that we want to be key, that are reaching out to try and do this in a way that we speak to the American people but protect American values. I think the Democratic Party has to do that. But I don't think you can put aside that we do not have the right, given personal conviction,
Tim,
to make that law.
Tim, I
think that's un-Christian. Jesus
same,
didn't do it.
That's the very same argument that slave owners made.
No, slave
in the
owners argued states' rights.
No,
what you're arguing is states' rights.
No,
that's what slave owners argued.
Slave owners said, people who supported slavery said, I wouldn't own a slave, but I don't have the right to tell somebody else whether they can own slaves. That's imposing my values.
Right.
What they forgot was slaves were people, and unborn babies are people, and in this society, no human being should have an absolute right of life and death over another human being.
May I respond to that? Slave owners use what you use. Let each state decide people's rights rather than have a federal government protect the rights of people. And I think that what we're trying to see is the right way. I didn't interrupt you, Reverend. I think what we're trying to see is the right wing is trying to bring us back to states' rights. And I think that states' rights is frightening for those that have been victimized.
Okay, now he is completely ignoring Richard Land's point. And Richard Land's point is, and it's probably the best point, if you only heard one thing in this entire interchange on Meet the Press, and you took away one thing, it was what Richard Land just said. And that is, look, this whole personally opposed but unwilling to impose argument doesn't wash, because you can't extend it to other moral issues. And the moral issue he mentions there is slavery. Those who were personally opposed to slavery but unwilling to impose that value on others were those who were in favor of slavery, or at least, at the very least, in favor of the status quo when it came to slavery before the Civil War. That's undeniable. And he's right to point out that Sharpton's position, I'm personally opposed but unwilling to impose my values on others in any legislative way, is precisely the position of the slave owner. Now, in another valiant attempt to change the subject, he says, no, this is about states' rights. Let me just say this. Now, this is just my opinion, but I guarantee you, if Roe v. Wade were overturned and went back to the states, you would find the pro-choicers arguing for the state's ability to regulate abortion. Why? Because it would be the only venue they could use. Then, suddenly, the states would have the power to permit abortion on demand. And they become instantly advocates for states' rights. Back to Meet the Press.
Oh, so let me ask you, you said something very interesting. You said, quote, the secular fundamentalism of the left is as much as a problem as the religious fundamentalism of the right.
That's right.
Would you apply that to abortion?
Well, this is a conversation that we're having all across the country now, and it's again about symbols more than I want solutions here. Pro-life and pro-choice people could unite together around working on teenage pregnancy, adoption reform, supporting low-income women. When you support them economically, the abortion rate falls. The abortion rate is way too high in America.
You're doing all those things, don't you?
You know, we're not. No one's pro-abortion. How do you prevent unwanted pregnancies? I'd like to find some common ground to work together to dramatically reduce the abortion rate. On so many of these issues, we get into polarized, ideological debates, and then we don't talk about how to solve the problem.
Okay, now just before he goes on any farther, and we get the response there from Jerry Falwell, he said something remarkable. Two remarkable things. And that was Jim Wallace of Sojourners. He said that we should be able to work together, pro-lifers and pro-choicers, for things that would reduce the number of abortions. And he's right. We actually could find common cause. I think there's even an organization by that name. We could find common cause on those things. Will we fundamentally disagree about the so-called woman's right to choose? Absolutely. But if the pro-choicers are earnest and honest when they say that they want to see abortion be safe, legal, and rare, then they should be willing to find common cause with pro-lifers in making it rare. We did a recent program on abortion legislation that didn't strike at abortion itself, but dealt with some of the underlying contributing factors to the abortion rate. It's a good thing to do. But he said something even more remarkable with which I disagree. And he said, no one is pro-abortion. Now, he tossed it in there. After he talked about working toward a common cause, no one's pro-abortion. I would beg to differ with Jim Wallace. Yes. In fact, the person who says I'm personally opposed, but I'm unwilling to impose that legislatively on abortion, for all intents and purposes, is pro-abortion. In the same way that someone during the days of slavery, who is personally opposed to slavery, but unwilling to impose that legislatively, is, for all intents and purposes, pro-slavery. And let's not be naive. There are entire political action groups, well-funded and well-funding political action groups devoted to perpetuating abortion on demand. They believe that abortion is a societal good. Now, because of the rhetorical force and because of the mood of the country, they're unwilling to state that outright as often as they used to. But they believe abortion is good for women. They are pro-abortion. It's just a little naive. Actually, it's very naive of Jim Wallace to say that no one is pro-abortion. That is simply not true. Look, I have less problem. Well, no, I have equal problem with someone who says, oh, I'm personally opposed. And they assuage their conscience by being personally opposed to abortion. Oh, but I'm unwilling to impose that legislatively on anyone else. In other words, I'm unwilling to criminalize abortion in any sense. I have really equal problem with that opinion as I do with someone who simply is honest and says, you know what? I'm pro-abortion. I'm in favor of it. Patricia Ireland, at one point in American history, would be willing to talk about abortion as good for women, as good for women's rights and women's progress. Now, she's not so willing to do it anymore, but in her more honest days, she was at least being honest. The personally opposed but unwilling to impose is a dishonest position.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The basic challenges of raising small children may be simple, but that doesn't mean they're easy. In the Christian home, how do we teach our small children about sin and about their Savior Jesus Christ? How do we guide them in their daily life as a baptized child of God, the life of daily repentance and the forgiveness of sins in Christ? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for November is called Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. Or, if your children are older, we're offering Faithfully Parenting Teens. You can order either of these books for $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers or Faithfully Parenting Teens.
the 67th book of the Bible. Is it true?
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, I've heard people who call themselves progressive creationists talk about a 67th book of the Bible. What are they meaning?
Well, a progressive creationist is someone who opposes biological evolution, but they add billions of years and other compromise ideas to the Bible. They talk about the creation around us as being the actual 67th book of the Bible. Now, because they interpret the creation as being billions of years old and the result of a Big Bang, they therefore argue that the Big Bang in billions of years is this 67th book. Because God cannot lie, they claim, therefore the Bible's 66 books must also be interpreted to mean billions of years. But you know, this claim of theirs is, in a word, preposterous. The creation, their so-called 67th book, is cursed because of sin. Also, nature doesn't tell us it's billions of years old. That's man's fallible interpretations about the past. Christians should never interpret the 66 books on the basis of a supposed 67th book, but they should interpret nature on the basis of the 66 books of the Bible. Fallible man gets it wrong so often when he tries to add man's ideas to the Bible instead of judging man's theories by the infallible word.
We have a free booklet on the real age of the earth available on our website, answersradio.com. All kinds of booklets are available there for your reading at answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Many children today idolize sports figures, movie stars, and rock musicians, partly because the media glorifies the wealth and glamour of these stars. However, numerous surveys have shown that there are two heroes that are admired and respected by more children than any other. That's mom and dad. More children, including teens, respect and admire their parents more than any media personality in sports or entertainment. So don't abandon your role as a hero to the media superstars. Use your status as your children's hero to set a good example. Remind your children that their real hero, above all other heroes, is Jesus Christ, who died on the cross for them. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I'm sitting in for Chuck Rather this week on the Bible study. Tuesday on the program, Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel and Director of Development at the Concordia Mission Society will walk us through Peter's Pentecost sermon in the middle verses of Acts chapter 2.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., Jim Carrey, he was on 60 Minutes a couple weeks back on Sunday night. It's very interesting. In this interview, he takes the interviewer up to a secluded spot on his vast property. I'm assuming this is in California where he lives. He's got a hilltop retreat. It's a little, what do they call these things? It's not a kiosk. It's not a pavilion. They have them where you sit on the beach. Cabana. Yeah. He didn't have a cabana boy, but he's got a cabana up there. It's his spiritual retreat. And when they get to the top of the hill and they're standing there under the shelter of his cabana, Jim Carrey, a very funny man, very bankable movie star and comedian, says, "I'm a Buddhist, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Christian, I'm whatever you want me to be." We're going to be talking about that tomorrow on Issues, Etc. Also, we'll discuss St. Andrew with Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, C.S. Lewis with Dr. Stephen Mueller of Concordia University in Irvine, California. All that tomorrow on Issues, Etc. Now, the phone lines are open for your reaction to yesterday's Meet the Press Roundtable with Jerry Falwell, Al Sharpton, Dr. Richard Land, and Jim Wallace, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If anything, this conversation, if you paid close attention to the course of it, you realize it was a microcosm of the whole public debate on the issue of life, on the issue of gay marriage, on the issue of values, whether or not one can have values without being willing to impose them, whether or not someone can be personally opposed to a thing without being willing to impose that value on others. Now, let me clarify one thing before we go on so that as time, so that if time does not permit, I don't fail to say this. And that is, as Christians who have values, not everything that Christians believe is sinful ought to be legislated. Not everything that is sinful ought to be illegal. Now, part of that is a matter of practicality. Living in a civil society, we cannot outlaw everything that God deems sinful. Even if we could, it wouldn't do us any good. It wouldn't improve us one whit. But also, there are things that Christians ought not to want to legislate that are patently sinful. We've talked recently with Greg Kokel about hate crimes legislation that seeks to make illegal the way you think, what you believe, how you feel. Now, the way a person thinks, what they believe, and how they feel can certainly be sinful. There are sinful thoughts. There are sinful beliefs. There are sinful feelings. Oh, yes, there are sinful feelings. I know you and I were both raised in the world where feelings aren't wrong. It's just what you do with them that's wrong. That's just nonsense. There are sinful feelings, folks. Lust, hate, rage. I can think of a whole bunch that Scripture regularly lists. But we cannot legislate against these things, which is why Christians are wise in the public square to make good, solid, prudential arguments against things like hate crime legislation. So not everything that is sinful ought to be illegal. So the question remains, and it's been the question that we've been dealing with throughout the course of this conversation here on the program, what values, what morals ought to be imposed in society through legislation? Back to the conversation.
We make abortion, Democrats safe, legal, and rare. Well, they're keeping it legal, but let's try to make abortion truly rare in the society. That is a common ground around which I think a lot of people, pro-life and pro-choice, could and should support.
Jim, let me ask you a question. Did you vote for John Kerry?
I did vote for John Kerry.
Now, he is pro-choice. How can you, as an ordained minister, you are an ordained minister, right?
Jerry.
How can you vote for I wouldn't vote for my mother if she were pro-choice.
You endorsed George Bush, that's fine, but you also you ordained him. You said all Christians could only vote for him. That's ridiculous.
Well,
there are
I can't command anybody. I can only tell you, if you take
candidates.
The Bible seriously, you're certainly going to have to, Psalm 139, 13 through 16, believe that life is sacred from conception on.
And Jerry, there are 3,000 verses in the Bible about the poor.
And I'm for all of those too.
But
George Bush,
the Republican agenda, was not satisfactory to many of the poor.
1.8 million people were added to the poverty lines in the last 4 years under George Bush. But Reverend, I think you have the right to vote for George Bush. I defend your right to do that, even though I disagree with it. We're talking about you not having the right to therefore bar others from exercising their personal decision.
All right, now this is just absolutely a specious argument, because the way you vote will result in certain people not being able to exercise absolute personal freedom. Let's just take this as an example. Had the majority of Americans voted for John Kerry, certain things would have happened in his administration that would have impinged upon the absolute personal freedoms of many people. Now, some of those things might have been good. Some of them might not have been good. Regardless of who is elected, George W. Bush was elected. And having him as a lawmaker, the values he brings into the office, the policies that he puts into place, all of these, in one way or another, to a greater degree or a lesser degree, impinge upon everyone's absolute personal freedom. It's a specious argument that Sharpton is making there. That somehow, voting for one candidate over another, one candidate isn't going to touch everyone's absolute personal freedom, whereas the other is. No, anyone you elect, you elect them to do that very thing. That's what legislation is. That's what government does. Government restricts man's freedom for the greater good of society. It does it within reason. Good government does it always toward the end of maximizing freedom, minimizing legislation that would impinge upon people's freedom, and yet keeping people safe and in a system of justice. Bad government maximizes the imposition of legislation that imposes upon freedom. But the government does it, period, good or bad. So let's just see through that argument as clearly as we possibly can.
Strange to me, Reverend, how the right wing wants to privatize public policy and make public private lives. I mean,
no,
people have the right to their private decisions. Jesus met the woman at the well. Jesus met the woman at the well. She was guilty of adultery. The state said she could be stoned. He stopped the stoning. You would condemn him for that. He wasn't condoning adultery.
I just would like Sharpton to get his Bible stories straight here. Now, granted, he's speaking off the cuff, and he is speaking apparently here in a bit of passion. But when Jesus met the woman at the well, yes, she had committed adultery. There was no stoning imminent. I think he's thinking about John chapter 8 and 9, where a woman was brought to him who had been caught in adultery, where a stoning was imminent. Now, interesting what Sharpton says there is that Jesus didn't want to see the state impose stoning on adultery. Well, in a sense, he's right. Not everything that is wrong should be illegal. But no one's arguing that adultery ought to be wrong. Again, the question comes down to what values ought to be imposed through legislation on the whole society. We're not going to impose all values. What Sharpton continues to bring up is this either or. Either you impose all values or you impose none. And even he doesn't want to impose none. So he ought to get his Bible stories straight as well. Now, we don't have time for all of this. Hopefully, we'll go through it off the air here. If there's something that's absolutely juicy and delectable, we will bring it to you a little bit later on Issues, etc. But time has gotten away from us. Now, if you enjoy what we do here on Issues, etc., when we bring you both a reiteration and commentary on the popular media, these things in the public debate, I would like you to support this Issues, etc. Moreover, if you find useful not only the fact that we're willing to comment on the public debate in the popular media, but with the focus upon focusing the Christian and the unbeliever on Christ and Him crucified, all the more reason to support the gospel outreach of Issues, etc. We have a Reformation Club. Become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer. Find out how by either looking at page 11 of the latest Issues, etc. journal, or calling our resource number, 1-800-737-0172. That's a way you can give by credit card. Go to our website to find out all the details on the Reformation Club. It's a monthly donor program, issuesetc.org. And you can also donate by check by writing us at Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. It's the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. Now, tomorrow, we'll be talking about Jim Carrey on 60 Minutes. We'll be talking about St. Andrew, also on Issues, Etc. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. How can parents apply the doctrines of law and gospel with their children? Find out with our Issues, Etc. Books of the Month for November. Faithfully Parenting Teens and Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. For more information, go to issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on the entire Faithfully Parenting series. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040.
AM 850 KFUO Clayton, St. Louis now concludes its broadcast day. KFUO AM operates with a signal strength of 5,000 watts on a frequency of 850 kilohertz. Some of today's programs may have contained persons or opinions not in agreement with the management of this station, the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Join us tomorrow when AM 850 KFUO returns to the air. Have a pleasant night, and may the peace of the Lord be with you.